Hey everybody, welcome to the Fight, Hustle, and Hurry podcast. Here we talk about the cultural pervasiveness and problem of hustle and hurry, and how as followers of Jesus, we can resist them in our daily lives. My name is Jeff Bethke, an author living in Maui, Hawaii, and I'm joined by John Mark Comer, a pastor and teacher at Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to season one. Hey guys, we are back. Episode 9. We're talking about empathy today. And when you hear that, you know that this is a podcast where we're leaning into spiritual discipline, spiritual formation, spiritual practices in the way of Jesus. And I bet most lists would not put empathy on there. And that one is from my book, To Hell with the Hustle. But I think it was so important because both of the topics that are on mine and John Mark's heart in this season, hurry, hustle, and all the pressures that come with those things, I think what we've realized is one of the things that we have to ask with when we lean into these things, what's something that we lose? What's a cost? What's a consequence of some of these things? And I think that one of the consequences of hustle and hurry is we are losing empathy. We're losing the power of it, the skill of it, and the ability of it. And I know for sure, without a doubt, as I talk in my chapter, I don't think people have to be convinced of this one, right? I don't think we put it in a spiritual practice category, but I don't think we have to be convinced of the problem. I think people clearly know, looking at politics, looking at some of our other institutions, that we're losing more and more empathy because of the vacuum of culture, the isolation of culture. And like we talked about in episodes ago, I think a couple episodes ago, of the collapse of so many institutions has now made politics and some other things have to bear more weight, which then makes us more vitriolic, more tribalistic. And John Mark, I want to hear you talk about that in a second. But yeah, definitions. Let's start there. Let's start. How would you define empathy? And I don't know if you want to get into some of the stuff you've talked about that I love about tribalism and community yet. But yeah, you just take in. What would you say empathy is and why it's so important?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I hear you say empathy, and I love that you put it in your book, it's one of my favorite chapters, but I think of empathy kind of as a synonym to compassion. You know,
that's good,
and
yeah.
So compassion, you know, cum is the Latin prefix there that the word is based on, means with, and then passion means suffering. And so I think with empathy or compassion, if I'm hearing you right, the idea is that you are, at least at an emotional level and ideally at a relational level as well, you are present with other people in their suffering or in their pain. So to have empathy or to have compassion is, man, I feel you. You know what I mean? I feel your pain. I feel what this would look like from your side of, if you're in a conflict with somebody, I feel what this would look like from your kind of vantage point, perspective. I see your side of the story, all of that. Empathy, compassion, patience, and ability to listen well, all of these things are dying off in our culture, you know, which is, and not that they're all that natural of the human condition anyway, but they're dying off.
Why do you think they're dying off?
Oh man, I think it's a complex thing. Personally, I would say the two biggest reasons, well, I would say three big reasons. Busyness, digital technology, and the rise of politics as the new religion.
Yep.
Busyness, you know, one of the most important books I read last year, and I hesitate to mention this because it was a controversial book, was called The Coddling of the American Mind. Did you read that?
Yeah, I love, man, that book was, and Righteous Mind too by him earlier. Yeah, the brilliant books.
Jonathan Haidt, and then Greg, how do you pronounce his last name? Lukanoff or whatever?
Yeah,
the
something like that.
Somebody.
Yeah, I love how you said Coddling, I didn't know it was controversial, but I guess when you're in Portland, yeah, that's a controversial book in Portland.
Well, yeah, in Portland, it's only controversial to like really far leftists or whatever. So it's basically, it's not written by conservatives. It's written by two secular, Haidt I know is an atheist.
Yeah, that's what I loved about it. They didn't have a huge dog in the fight. It was
inner,
just more research.
Yeah. And they're progressives, they're like, calm kind of inner progressives. They're not like, you know, super far left. So if you were to look at the left-right spectrum, they're kind of center left, I guess. And they're just writing about how far left politics has gone. And specifically, you know, one's a social psychologist, the other's an expert in free speech and runs a nonprofit advocating for free speech, which obviously has lots of controversy with millennials on the farther left, like wanting to curb free speech on college campuses, political discourse. Anyway, they talk about just the level of outrage in politics right now. The Twitter sphere, like how angry, like their level of anxiety, outrage, the vitriol, all the massive protests breaking out on campus, not at the places you would expect, actually at the most liberal progressive colleges in the world, Reed College in Portland, Evergreen up in Seattle, Berkeley, like all of the great unrest is at the most progressive woke colleges in the world. So that there's an interesting phenomenon there. And anyway, they have six, they basically say, we think this is about politics or even race or whatever, but actually it's about a whole list of other things as well. Yeah. And they have six explanatory threads, I'm going somewhere with this, for why we're at such a level of outrage and, you know, polarization and anger in the political conversation. And it's interesting, one of their political threads, and basically they all have to do with busyness, but one of the political threads is the decline in free play. And this is like, I never would have thought of this. This is like social psychologist deep data dive. So they talk about the decline of free play for Gen Z and how it used to be that like after school, you'd come home, maybe you do your homework, and then you go out in the neighborhood and you just play with neighborhood kids and you'd run around. And what happens in free play is you learn how to do justice, basically. You learn how to deal with conflict. You know, so let's say you want to play tag or whatever, and you have three kids in fourth grade and, you know, six kids in first grade. So you naturally, you don't do like, you know, you don't, you have to make it even, right? Yeah. So like they have a handicap, they have to touch you twice.
You're constantly equalizing.
You're constantly equalizing. Yep. You're learning how to deal with conflict. You're learning how to stand up for yourself, but also how to listen to the other side. If you get in a fight, you're learning how to repent and apologize. If you break a window, you have to pay for it. You're learning all of these like hyper important lessons about how to be in relationship and love and community. And basically what's happened is free play has gone extinct. If you're in a city, because there are just barely any children in the city and it's urbanized, but even if you're not in a city, you have for lower class and middle class kids, basically the TV and video games have taken up all of their free time. So you go into a neighborhood, even where there are a lot of kids out in the suburbs or whatever, a smaller town, and you don't see them playing outside.
Yeah, they're all playing Fortnite.
Yeah, they're playing Fortnite or watching TV. And then for upper middle class and wealthy kids, they have video games and TV too, but basically college prep now starts at like first grade. So you're off to like chess club and fencing class and swim lessons and Latin tutor, and you're playing the violin.
The insane pressure of what you need to be when you're older.
Yes. You're just driven around, like, because we're prepping you for Harvard at, you know, by kindergarten at your private school or whatever. So either way, basically from across classes, free play is gone. And they basically say what happens when you don't learn the lessons of free play. This was the key insight. The only way you know how to get what you want is by appealing to authorities over you to coerce others to do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
And they weren't even saying there's not a place for that. But they're saying in that there's no horizontal give, take, nuance, you know, deal, work it out. All right. So I think that's one example of the way that busyness has just ratcheted us up to this crazy go-go space where we're always late, agitated, impatient, angry. And that bleeds into the political sphere. I think the other thing is technology basically allows this self-perpetuating cycle where anxiety feeds on anxiety, feeds on anxiety, anger feeds on anger, feeds on anger. You know, the Twitter sphere, the echo chamber, like it's just so much of it is built around anger. So that—
Which you can't be empathetic at the same time. So then that goes lower and lower as anger goes up and up.
Yep. And then the last thing I'd say is just the decline of religion, spirituality, the rise of secularism, you know, and Newbegin predicted this back in the 50s. He said, as Christianity declines in the West, politics will become the new religion.
Yeah.
And that's what we're happening because people no longer, and I recognize the abuses of this by the church in the past, but because people no longer put their ultimate hope in Jesus saving the human soul to make it into a being of love now, and then ushering in the kingdom of God in the future, now our ultimate hope becomes, let's get the right president, the right political party, the right legislation that aligns with our vision of flourishing, and they need to do it, and they need to do it now. Yeah. And so the level of religious fervor, you know, orthodoxy, punishment of the heretic, anybody that would dare disagree with your political view is a heretic now. Yeah. You know, like the emotion, the spirituality that people put into tax reform or whatever it is. And yeah. I'm not saying these things don't matter. I know I'm saying these things as a middle-class white male. I fully am aware of that. I don't want to speak insensitively to that. I'm just saying, man, I think a lot of this conversation is just full of anger, anxiety, and a religious fervor around politics.
Yeah,
that, and I think that has so made empathy and compassion almost non-existent.
Yeah, because those none of those can coexist that you just said. So it automatically starts escaping out of your heart and mind. And as followers of Jesus, who I would say that's what we're probably mostly chatting, who are listening, there's even, because there's a different ethic there too, right? Meaning like we're following the way of Jesus and his way can't be motivated by, you know, some of the hurry and hustle and, you know,
anger
and frustration and all these other things that needs to be motivated by love, right? To love God and to love neighbor and to do it for the right ways and the right reasons. And then empathy has the soil to grow. And why it's important too is I don't think we named the chapter this on the edits, but we almost named it early on as just like the power to change the world. And that was the chapter on empathy. Like it is, I do think it's one of the critical things right now that can actually connect people in a way that they deeply need, change people in a way that they deeply need. And back to even your free play example, I love that example, especially in their book, because another thing that I think they talk about, but we realize too, is what free play did is it just puts you in the center of like other people's experiences. Like we're one of the first cultures in human history who's actually able to fully like not even have, we're able to totally echo chamber ourselves, which is very difficult to do, but with technology and stuff, it's very easy to do. So we actually now have systems in place. Like, and I use this example in the book, which I just haunts me actually. Imagine if a newspaper company, like imagine if you went out to your front porch and got your newspaper, and when you read it, you were reading a different newspaper than your neighbor, right? And then they were reading a different one than them. Like there were like, not that there was like three newspaper companies, but that there was actually like your whole street all got a different newspaper. That's called the social media algorithm. You are all getting, you right, curated stuff that puts a different news in front of you than everyone else. And at some level it leans in certain directions. And I'm like, man, that you would think that's really weird if it was actual physical paper on your doorstep, right? That I'm getting a different newspaper than my neighbor, that's giving me a different reality, a different point of view, and a different direction. But the minute it's TV or social media, we just say, oh yeah, that's kind of part of it. I'm like, well, no, that's forming us. That's forming us. And it's de-empathizing ourselves. And so I think of Jesus, right? So you look at Jesus, and because at some level, I think another way that I've heard too is like sympathy is like, you know, kind of a softer version, but then empathy is more the harder version of like really trying to empathize with someone means getting in their shoes, really understanding and trying to feel for them, feel what it's like, understand what it's like to walk in their shoes. And I just am like, man, Jesus sets that example times a million. He doesn't walk in our shoes. He like literally puts on a body, right? He doesn't put on shoes. He puts on our body. He puts on our flesh and he comes among us, walks among us, knows what it feels like to be us, to cry, to be sad, to be happy, to have broken relationships, to have friends die, for him to die himself. Man, like, and to think of that, that he was so willing to step into our dimension and life and body. And I think that's why you then see him be so tender and see him be so gentle and see him be so kind and see him be so powerful with his kingdom movement, because it was coming out of this empathetic place of him stepping and stooping to us. And so I don't know what you would say to that, John Mark, but how do you kind of then think we get away from the stuff we're saying? Like, how do we enter into that way of Jesus? How do we kind of cultivate empathy in a culture that's constantly telling us to not be, that it's weak, that it's wrong, that it's bad, that you're not able to, or just if you're just from the noise, just, you know, being more angered so you can't be empathetic. How do you kind of escape that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I love Jesus as the example, and I love Jesus because he does get angry at times, and mm-hmm. there is a place for anger. Yes. I just think that Jesus' version of anger is so different than most of our version of anger. Jesus' anger was all like others centered in love. Yeah. Our anger is often just when people cross us and we don't get what we want, you know? Yeah. And so like, I think of Jesus, you know, rhetoric with the Pharisees, which is like full on frontal assault, anger, you know what I mean? because the level of hard-heartedness, corruption, mm-hmm. spiritual abuse, like the havoc they were wreaking yeah. on people below them, like Jesus doesn't practice compassion with them as much as he does, you know, yeah. attack. And so there is a place for that. And in particular, as we think about some of the injustices of our day around race or whatever, there's a place for anger. But Jesus is very careful and selective with who that is directed at, yeah. you know? And people that are in front of him in person, not online, and are like full on the oppressor kind of thing.
Yep.
Most of the time what Jesus models is compassion. And I think when I look at the life of Jesus and when I think about my own experience and follow him, the two like more concrete practices that I think lead to this. And what I love about empathy or compassion is it's not a practice, it's the fruit of practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like spiritual disciplines are all a means to an end. The yeah. end is, empathy is not a means, empathy is an end to an extent. Yeah. So, you know
what
I mean?
It's produced in us when we give ourselves space yes. and time and rest.
Because it's a form of love. Empathy is yep. a form of compassion. It's a form of love.
Yep.
So these other spiritual disciplines of silence and solitude, Sabbath, slowing, simplicity, these are means. The end is how do we become, here's one of many, empathetic yep. people who sit with each other in love and suffer with other people. So I think the two disciplines that I specifically think of, in addition to just slowing your life down, because we tend to just be more angry and irritated mm. and anxious when we're in a hurry, which brings out our worst, not our best, but are specifically silence. Like, you know, Henry Nouwen, I think we quoted him earlier, said that compassion is the fruit of silence. Mm. And most of the contemplative writers all point out that, you know, and even outside of the Jesus tradition, like in Buddhist contemplative, you know, practice or whatever, like there's all sorts of people that connect the dots between quiet, stillness, contemplative prayer, abiding, and like the fruit of compassion in your life, mm. which is not surprising for lots of reasons. One, it just lets your nervous system calm down at a physical yep. level, which is why I think it does this even for Buddhists and Hindus and people that aren't praying to the spirit of Jesus. But two, you know, in God's self-description of himself in Exodus, you know, when he's on Mount Sinai, when God tells Israel who he is, what his personality is, the number one thing on his list is compassionate. Yeah. Compassionate, gracious, slow to anger. Like that's, for God, the most important thing, the defining trait of who God is, his baseline emotion toward you yep. and the world is compassion. And so I think when you slow down and your nervous system calms down and you spend time with the spirit of the compassionate God, you are then transformed into compassion. So often I go into silence and solitude angry at my lovely wife or my child yep. or somebody at the church or some critical comment online yeah. or whatever. And compassion, as I sit with it long enough, rises in my heart. The other practice that I think is key to this is just listening. So I've been learning a lot about just the power of listening, you know, and that I've read some interesting like secular psychological studies on how in the brain, listening well is virtually indistinguishable from loving well. So when people feel felt, that's the psychological language, feeling felt, meaning when you sit with somebody and you feel like they hear you out yeah. and they listen and their eyes are there and they value you and they honor you, even if they fully disagree with you,
yeah.
you feel loved. Like I had this weird experience a few weeks ago. I sat with a couple in our church that is leaving our church, I think, and it was a hard conversation. They're going to a different theological place that's much more progressive than we think is the way of Jesus. And yeah. it was a agree to disagree thing. And it was, and they were asking me some questions and I was basically saying some really hard things to them, you know?
Yeah.
But they're wonderful people. I love them. We have years of relationship. And it's interesting, they said to me afterwards, "Thank you so much. We just felt so loved." And I thought, that's so weird. I told yeah. you everything you did not want to hear,
yeah.
you know? But something about like, and we left disagreeing with each other, but somehow their experience was, I felt loved. Mm. And loved was not agreed with at all. And like, I disagreed with them, but love was just hearing each other. And I think that even when we can't agree on issues, there's something about just hearing, like we've been running, well, I won't go into that, but there's just something about listening. So I think yeah. those two practices for me of quiet and of listening help cultivate empathy and compassion, especially for people like, this has been so good for me as a white dude to just listen to people of color and listen to people in our church and hear what their experience is like in the same city, in the same church. And I'm like, once I depoliticize like the Twitter rhetoric around it and just sit with people of color and listen to them, oh my gosh, like the level of compassion, empathy, solidarity, like, oh my gosh, we have to fix this, that rises up in my heart is so different than when I'm attacked and shamed because of the color of my skin or whatever by some anonymous person online, you know?
Yeah, there's something about when you listen, like you said, that then you actually start to, I mean, marriage is obviously one of the supreme examples of that in regards to proximity of intimacy, just meaning like when you're by someone for such a long period of time and with close with someone for such a long period of time and you're leaning in, you're not hardening and turning away, it just... Right. You start to take them on, like in you, right? You start to take their feelings on, you start to take their thoughts on, their burdens on, and it's kind of when you're facing them in their direction, all it really takes is proximity, and it naturally happens, I think, at some level, if you're like leaning in with that spirit. But yeah, it doesn't happen as well from a keyboard or from the internet, and so I think because a lot of us spend more time there now, a lot of our relationships are a little more vacuumed or sucked away in regards to real community and true walking life, that we tend to, not be as empathetic. But I think, and back to the play example again, too, they're not just, but you get, when you get to see someone's face or when you get to see someone when they are hurt, it does something different to you when it's a two-way street, not a one-way street. Do you know what I mean? Like when you, like we are as creatures, we feel people's pain, we see pain in their face, but you can't feel or see pain on the internet. And that's where I think it gets
so detrimental.
But you can
cause pain. You can cause pain on the internet.
Well, exactly. That's the point, is that it can go, it's a one-way street. You can shoot it that way, which you can do in real life, but it's different when you can then see their pain coming back to you of what you just did. There's no consequence. There's no kind of, for lack of a better term, like most of us aren't monsters, right? So when you can actually see someone and what maybe a comment did or with something, you're like, oh, that kind of twinges you a little, right? And I think those are actually a lot of checks in our spirit to keep us empathetic if you stay soft. What would be your final encouragement as a first step for someone? Because I do think this one's actually really critical for all of us, man. We really got to lean into this, especially with the internet culture, especially with how we're speaking to each other, especially Christians. What's kind of the first step? You think it's like a season or time of introspection of just like processing people maybe in their life? Do you think it's just processing how they, interact online? What would you say kind of that first step is for someone?
Well, I mean, I think the very first step is to have it as a key value. Like less and less is compassion even a goal for people in the West, you know? And or a compassionate, empathetic, kind, listening heart. You know, I mean, not a lot of people would disagree with that, but I just think for a lot of people, that's not at the top of their list. Again, God's self-description of himself on Mount Sinai, the first thing on his list is I'm compassionate. Mm. And this same word is used of Jesus all the time. Jesus, when he saw the crowds, was, quote, moved with compassion because they were like sheep without a shepherd.
Yes.
Jesus is moved with and by compassion.
But if you just read their stories online, you might not have been.
Yes, totally. And so I think, that's a huge one.
That's a good
one of the things that I do. And then just slow your life down and then connect the dots between hurry and compassion. The more hurried you are, the less compassionate you will likely be. Just connect the dots. And if you don't believe me, just notice yourself. If you're a parent, this is the easiest. Just notice yourself next time you're trying to get your kids out the door on time. And
tons
you're late.
Tons of compassion when you're hurried.
And you're in a hurry. Just notice how much compassion you have. Or notice next time you're in a fight with your roommate or parent and you don't have time for it. You're late.
That's our magic phrase in our marriage of like, Alyssa hates it, but when I'm at my worst, that's the phrase that comes out of like, I don't have time for this.
And exactly. I don't have time for it. So what happens? You don't have time
then
for
I'm not
compassion.
Loving. Yep.
Because compassion, to have compassion, you have to listen.
It takes time.
To take time to feel and for your amygdala to like calm down. And that takes time. And so if you don't have time, you won't have compassion.
Yeah.
And then third, I would just say, start cultivating some acts of quiet and slowing and listening to cultivate compassion in your heart. Like one of the things that I do each morning, this is a whole other podcast series, but I've been fascinated by the connections between spirituality and neuroscience. And there's this whole new emerging field called neurotheology and I'm just really interested in what Paul calls the renewal of the mind and what we can learn from what scientists call neuroplasticity and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things I'm learning from both secular psychologists and spiritual formation writers, ancient and modern, is that we become like what we meditate on, what we give our mind and our attention to. So each morning, I've just been spending a few minutes just in meditation, in the quiet, before I start my day, on the compassion, love, joy, and peace of Jesus coming toward me. And I just imagine myself with all of my sins sitting in the eyes of compassion, love, joy, and peace of Jesus. And then I begin to visualize myself offering that compassion, love, joy, and peace to the people that I know I plan to see that day. Now, is it a cure-all? No. Am I like just now always pure, like, you know, Mother Teresa awesome? Yeah. No, at all. I get angry. I get in a hurry. I'm uncompassionate at times. I say, I don't have time for this. But that simple exercise is changing my life.
Let's end with that, you guys. But what would it look like? And I don't know where you're listening to this. Maybe the gym, maybe the morning, maybe nighttime. So maybe you can't do it right now, but if you could carve out 5 minutes, I would suggest doing it. Or maybe if you can just think of a time at lunch, a break or something like that. I love that exercise. What would it look like to take time to dwell on that? And I love how it's like step one, step two. You have to be saturated at the feet of Jesus and who he says you are, what's true about him, and what the goodness of himself is that he gives you. And then you can then contemplate how you will then go and give that to others. So we love you guys. We'll see you next week.